Good afternoon, folks, and welcome back once again to another edition of the Come Out of Her My People show. I'm your host, Mark Call. And this is the show where we talk about so many aspects of that verse from Revelation 18:4 each and every week that says, come out of her, my people, do not participate in her sins so that we do not partake of her plagues. And this week, I think, is a particularly appropriate week to get together, maybe even take a break from some of the things that we often talk about that are related to the news and to tyranny and the march of all kinds of things antithetical to the creator of the universe, and instead focus on some of the other things more appropriate to this time of Sukkot. So let me start there and note that this is, of course, a feast time. It's often associated, matter of fact, it's always associated ultimately with the time of year, at least in the northern hemisphere, with the harvest. A lot of times the metaphor that Yeshua used frequently of the wedding. It's also, for those of us that have been paying attention and studied what Scripture really says, nope, it was never, ever said that he was born in the month of December, but it is the time of the real birth of the Mashiach. It's also a real good time because the Bible tells us to practice for things that are to come. Paul says it's a shadow picture of things to come. And we're also aware that he says we should remember the time in booths, in Sukkot, tents, temporary structures in the wilderness, not only because it happened before, but because, well, we've been promised it's going to happen again. And I guess you could say there's probably a lot of other things, too, that we probably won't know until they happen. But I'm going to suggest this as well. It's also a time for reflection, for prayer, and for preparation. That's part of the reason why I want to talk about some specifics that we probably haven't dealt with here for a while. One more thing about Sukkot, though, that'll take us there. This is also a good time for practice of the come out of her principle. Well, think about it. We live in a world which prefers a paganized, fuzzy, wuzzy savior that was born on Mithra, the sun god's birthday, and who allegedly, at least if you believe what the whore church teaches, even did away with his own written law. How's that for another Jesus whom we've not preached? That same fake loves funny money, and he promises lots of it, along with tax deductions too, for those that will take his 501c3 mark, all right? If you see a certain amount of cynicism there, you should, because if you read Scripture and recognize that what we have got in the way of the whore church is so far from what the real Messiah taught and was and said that we ought to be doing, if you love me, keep my commandments, and so forth, that almost, I think it's fair to say, the whore church and what it teaches on Sun God Day is virtually unrecognizable from Scripture. A whole lot of stuff about love, but remember, love includes two guys living with a parakeet and saying, hey, we just might be trannies too. In other words, whatever it was that was written in that old, done away with law, we don't care about anymore. We don't teach it to our kids. As a matter of fact, the new gods may just take your kids away from you if you dare to suggest that that old one has anything worth reading about, much less walking in obedience to. So that's where I kind of want to go today, but as usual, with a little bit of a practical bent that is appropriate to the time and the season here, this idea of reflection and prayer and preparation and some of the things that we are that we're seeing come down. One of them, obviously, is a dollar collapse, the inevitable end of every single fiat currency in history. Is it going to happen tomorrow? Well, you don't know. It's October, after all. Black Friday, a number of things have happened in October. It tends to be kind of a nasty month for fake money markets. But with all that aside, still, there are a number of things that we can see happening. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the news this week, but I am going to simply point out that if we believe and see what is going on and recognize that what he tells us, the way we're supposed to deal with it, is to come out of her, well, then this time of the year, this season, this feast, is a great time to practice, to think about again, to prayerfully reflect on how we can do that. And with that in mind, I'm going to talk about at least one or two that are very much related, specific aspects of what that might look like and what I'm going to suggest we had better get used to because it's coming. And with that in mind, I'm looking at a couple articles here. I'll give you some of these as we go through them. The first one I'm going to at least excerpt a bit from and lever off comes from Brandon Smith at altmarket.us, and it's called Solutions Are Scary. This is actually the second of two parts. I may touch on the other one here in a minute, but the second one has to do with what he calls rebellion and black markets. In other words, black markets are the alternative, and he doesn't use this terminology, which is a bit disappointing, but I will, to the coming mark of the beast. He says, understand that after physical safety, if you can't protect yourself, if you're not armed, you remember what Yeshua said, if you don't have one, go buy a sword. Well, if you're not armed, if you can't protect your physical safety, then you probably have other things to worry about. But thereafter follows economic preparedness. Can you feed your family? Can you take care of yourself? And he introduces where he wants to go this way. I think it's a reasonable way to look at it. If you were to examine the entire spectrum of globalist policies and programs from the U.S. to Europe to Asia, all the things Big Brother International wants to do to you, including climate controls, carbon credits, and, mass genocide, central bank digital currencies, cashless societies, the vaccine passports, biometrics, agricultural controls, the Great Reset, the Fourth Industrial Revolution, the coming AI monitoring of everything, including transactions, there's your mark of the beast. Again, he doesn't call it that. Well, you will inevitably come to the same conclusion. And that's the one he says he has. Almost everything they do revolves around, I'll say it this way, control. They want to control you. They want to limit what you can do. They want to destroy freedom. They want to micromanage everything associated with what you slaves are allowed to have, eat, possess, and not possess. And of course, access to resources. And it's not just international trade, but all kinds of trade, including the average person's grocery purchases, private barter. And I agree with this completely, as he puts it. If they get their way, you won't so much as be allowed to grow a garden in your backyard. And that, folks, is very true, because gardens and the ability to feed yourself outside of the mark of the beast system is a very big threat to them. Think I'm exaggerating, says Brandon Smith. Just look at what happened during the attempted COVID pandemic lockdowns. Leftist state governments denied people access to foods, to job, without vaccination status, in other words, being a good little slave. And at least one tyrannical state, People's Republic of Michigan, literally tried to stop people from buying garden seeds. Now, if you understand the value of seeds, and that's one of the things that should be at the top of every prepper's list, during this harvest season, by the way, yours truly and family, I'm trying to save as many seeds as I can, because I learned a few years back that if you grow seeds and save seeds from plants that work well in your own climate and soil conditions and so forth, they will do better, generally, year after year as they acclimate themselves. In other words, a tomato that's been growing for a couple of years and is now in its third generation, so in your soil, in your climate, tends to do a better job of producing. And I can say that's true this year for sure than others that have come before it. So save those seeds and recognize they can literally and ultimately will be worth their weight in gold. All right. Many places, says Brandon Smith, including Hawaii, tried to arrest people for just being outside on parks and beaches and so forth. And it's idiotic, and it runs afoul of so-called science, real science, as opposed to the Fauci godlike kind, because you can't transmit or contract a virus generally in the outdoors where open air and sunlight, vitamin D, things your body produces, generally kill diseases. Yet it's not about preventing disease. It was about control. And also that includes social interactions and economic participations. So, says Smith, I have contended, and I agree with him, folks, that one of the primary purposes of the pandemic practice session, the lockdowns, were to acclimate the public to the idea of rationing and the fact that Big Brother does own you, you little peon slave you. If they say 6 feet, it may be stupid, but you had better stay 6 feet apart and wear your good little slave mark, that mask that identifies you as one who doesn't care about the oxygen content in his blood or his brain. All right. Rationing also erases any last vestiges of a free market and turns the buying of necessities into privileges instead of a God-given, once constitutionally protected right. And now, along with other things, they're trying to demonize the very concept of prepping itself as a form of hoarding. Because you see, in a communist society, if you got something that they don't want you to have, you're a hoarder. And that means they could take it. Isn't that convenient? purpose of economic controls is obvious, he continues. If you control people's access to things they need, supplies, income, then they're far less likely to rebel against you, especially if you take away their firearms. So that then when you do turn the screws and take their freedoms, after you've taken their firearms, they won't be able to say no. This has been the mainstay of tyrants in the 20th century, Mao, Stalin, Pol Pot, you name it, Biden-Fuhrer. And it's been a mainstay of feudal empires since the Middle Ages. And the idea of trade controls is at the core of the agenda of the modern-day deep state and, of course, World Economic Forum and other Fourth Reich elements. Ruling at the barrel of guns is not necessarily as viable strategy today, unless you're in Australia or someplace like that, at least in the United States. But they're getting there, and one of the ways they're doing it is using indirect methods to gain compliance until the point of complete disarmament. And don't worry, you'll probably see some very high-profile events that will facilitate that. Who knows, but I would suspect real soon now. All this trend, he says, forces the liberty-minded to try to adopt alternatives, especially alternative economic systems, because if you can't feed yourself, you certainly can't fight. And whether you like the term or not, these amount to essentially black markets. All right? So let's get over the taboo of talking about certain things. Just remember, if Big Brother doesn't want you to have it, and they have a mark of the beast, and you say no to it, well, if they can, they'll kill you. They certainly intend to starve you, poison you, take away whatever residual freedom you have, and, cut off the genitalia of your kids and inject them with poisons, too, if they can get away with it. That'll probably be one of the conditions associated with this mark. You can see how all this plays out. So essentially what he's saying, and I agree, get used to the idea of black markets. Study the tactics of gun runners and drug dealers over the past few decades, and you'll see what it probably looks like when it comes to the economy of the future, although it's going to be on a bigger scale. Much of what we currently do, and you can pretty much set your watch by this, it'll tell you where we are along the time scale, will eventually be treated as illegal, illicit, Achtung verboten. Unless, of course, it's specifically sanctioned by Big Brother, in which case it's probably not intended to do anything except harm you, kill you, or take away what residual freedoms you have. They will attempt to do everything they can to shut down private production and trade. And then, of course, there's the issue of economic collapse, too, which we're already beginning to experience in the form of stagflation, Bidenflation, and so forth. And that is going to get a lot worse in the next couple of years. So establishing alternatives before the inflation takes away what ability you currently have to even do that has got to be a top priority, he says. And the end game, you know it, slavery and servitude, unless you can learn to walk away, I would say come out of her, from the broken economy. And let's understand this. Part of the reason why I do this show is because time is short, so do it now. All right. The next section he talks about has to do with this idea of barter, one of the elements of the black market. Understand that Americans, whether it's the state or the county level, will need ultimately to ignore various federal restrictions on resource management. In other words, there are going to be things you're going to need, whether it's food or materials like wood or steel or copper, you name it, plastics, whatever it might be, and those will be managed and controlled, and they'll be verboten. So unless there is a supply chain for local or domestic use only, you won't have them. The value of labor and barter markets, he says, as a means of rebellion is completely impossible to overstate. I continue to believe this is an incredible tool, says Branham Smith, for defeating economic tyranny. But the bottom line is this. Barter markets need producers in order to stay viable. Now, I think that's an important thing to consider. In other words, eventually stuff wears out. Eventually you eat up the food. Eventually things run down. And unless you can replace them or have people who can make them, fix them, build them, you're going to run out. So think about this idea of producers needed in order to stay viable. In other words, we will need people. And here's part of what I have been encouraging people to think about, pray about, plan for forever. People who can make things, right? Can you run a metal lathe or a wood lathe? Can you build things? Can you fix things, grow things, teach things? It can't just be about trading goods and things you already have on hand. By the way, I mentioned this earlier too, but can you fix people as well? In other words, there are going to need to be medical experts. And I'm not talking about people who can prescribe pills and basically say, oh, if you didn't take your poison poke, I won't work on you. Those people don't belong in anything approaching a free society or a barter economy, folks. Find yourself somebody useful, in other words. But the point is, people need to be able to add value to the market by creating things, whether it's services or items that people want. And on that score, one last comment, I guess. I'm not necessarily talking about trinkets or artwork. I doubt that Hunter Biden's paintings will sell in a free community for $100,000. As a matter of fact, I doubt there'll be much market for them at all unless people have wood stoves. On the other hand, friend of mine used to call doodads, knickknacks, and dustables, things that sit on a countertop and take up space, probably aren't going to be of much value. On the other hand, clothes, pots, pans, socks, tools, lots of things people can make and repair, maybe darning socks, all of those are going to be valuable. It's amazing when you have a cold winter just how wonderful a good pair of socks can seem if you don't have any. Same thing goes for fixing shoes and boots and so forth. Barter markets, he notes, can be on a small neighborhood scale up to a county level. People can trade with each other, especially if they've stockpiled vital commodities while they last. But all of that is a stopgap measure unless you understand that you need some kind of a measure of value in order to facilitate trade. In other words, we're talking about something that's been called money or currency, and that has to be introduced. Now, he talks about a lot of things, obviously, and I guess that since I've mentioned before, I'm not going to spend much time on, script created at a local level with other kinds of governmental solutions. Cryptocurrencies, I do agree with him on this, are a distraction from legitimate solutions for a number of reasons. Why? Well, if people don't have computers, they don't have power to run computers, what good are they? And the truth is, when things break down, most people aren't going to regard bits on a computer as being particularly valuable if they're not even sure tomorrow that they're going to be able to use them for anything. On the other hand, a piece of gold or silver or some grain or salt or whatever it might be that you can hold in your hand, well, that is tangible wealth. All of this, he says, though, it means a convertible currency mechanism. Maybe a physical note backed by a commodity. I'm not so big on that. If trust fails, why would I trust somebody to honor a physical note? There's a line from my favorite author, Robert Heinlein, when I was growing up that I loved. He says, if a man speaks of his honor, make him pay cash. Better still, silver. Commodities would have to have storage capacity, and they'd need to be portable. You can look up on any economics text the five basic concepts of money, portability, fungibility, value, so forth and so on. Things like gold, silver, copper, wheat, oil, rice, and so on. I could add other things. I've already mentioned some of them. Salt. Animals have been a measure of wealth throughout history. They can produce meat or milk. Eggs, chickens, all of those kinds of things have real value, especially if people are starving. And of course, it goes without saying, but I'll mention it anyway, that things like this need to be pursued now before the economic collapse and the dollar collapse play out. Brandon Smith seems to think that, it's important that we explore these systems. I tend to suggest, honestly, even if people don't understand the value of silver, once they've been hungry for a few days, once things collapse, they'll realize, we really have had a solution, honest weights and measures, money, for about 6,000 years or so that has stood the test of time. So I don't think people need to be worrying about setting up systems. Perhaps introducing folks to the idea of why having some silver on hand is a good thing. I'm all in favor of that. Over the years, I've talked to dentists and plumbers and chiropractors and others. Hey, you could trade your services for silver and be a lot better off. And many have begun to understand that. That's a good thing. Brandon Smith goes on to talk about a couple of other things I'm not going to talk about in much detail, because what I want to do instead is mention, as we are looking at these alternatives, there's another element here. Yes, it's important to have a market and a way to exchange in that market. Yeah, barter's fine if somebody happens to have what you want and they happen to want what you have. But on the other hand, the value of a silver dollar or a silver quarter or a silver dime for a dozen eggs, whatever it might be, is that even if they don't want your dozen eggs right now, or vice versa, well, The silver dime will be valuable later because it has a value to somebody else who might want to exchange something you do want for it. From there, what I want to do is go to some of the pitfalls. This one is something I've talked about from time to time. I realize I haven't done much on one of the most important Supreme Court cases and actually most satanic in American history in quite a while. And it's called Commerce Clause Abuse. At least that's the name of the article that I'm looking at from the late professor, sadly, Walter Williams. Wonderful fella. I love the man. Never had a chance to meet him. Early on in my radio career, I had a chance to interview him, and unfortunately, it didn't quite pan out, and that's one of the big disappointments that I look back on now that he's passed. But in any case, this is a wonderful piece. It has to do with killing the Constitution. And Article 1, Section 8, which gives Congress the authority to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among these several states and with the Indian tribes. But that does not mean control all commerce. Well, folks, that has been what has happened. And that's the point of what Professor Williams is talking about here. And it's what I want to spend a few minutes on, because as we look at alternatives and think about ways to come out of the system, I'm going to suggest ultimately it won't matter when the federal government completely blows up and people lose complete respect for it. And that will eventually happen. It may be a really ugly time by then. But what we need to do in the meanwhile is understand how to come out of her in such a way that we don't give them an excuse to make an example of us too early. Ultimately, they're going to hate anybody and everything that rejects them and doesn't take their mark. So let's not kid ourselves. That is coming. But in the meanwhile, I'm going to suggest if we understand some things like how you get roped into this system, and it's been part of the come out of her exercise and milieu on this show since day one. Well, we're always going to be better off. All right, on to Professor Walter Williams and Commerce Clause Abuse. He says, for most of our history, the courts, back when we had courts, foiled congressional attempts to use the so-called Commerce Clause to sabotage the clear meaning of the Constitution, particularly the 8th, 9th, 10th Amendments, and so forth. The courts began caving into congressional tyranny, though, during the New Deal era, the 1930s. This was sealed in 1942 by a little-known but truly wicked Supreme Court ruling, and maybe that's how you can remember the name, Wickard v. Filburn. All right, the story goes like this. Mr. Filburn was a small farmer in Ohio. The Department of Agriculture, which has, since then revealed its ugly true mission to destroy agriculture, to destroy the ability of people to feed themselves. Anyway, they had set production quotas during public-private partnership, fascist New Deal era. Mr. Filburn harvested nearly 12 acres of wheat above his official Achtung government allotment. And he argued that that excess wheat was unrelated to commerce because he didn't intend to sell it. It was just for his own use. That didn't fly. They fined him anyway. And the court claimed their reasoning, and I don't use that terminology in this context at all, but they claimed that, this wheat, had he not grown the extra wheat, well, he'd have had to purchase it. So there you go. Indirectly, that affected interstate commerce. Now, this is where I get a little bit frosted, and I'll point out what should be obvious, but it's not to idiots that, basically they're not idiots. They know what they're doing. They want to control you. And how are you going to get to a mark of the beast unless you control everything that everybody does all the time? So, indirectly affecting interstate commerce is the ruse here. And I'll say that by that logic, and we've seen this in practice, anything that anyone can buy, or maybe doesn't even buy, somehow affects interstate commerce. Isn't that clever? Whether you eat something or don't eat it, whether you talk or write about something, or even breathe, butterfly wings too, all of them affect interstate commerce, ultimately. So this is like a blank check, and you got to figure, oh, Big Brother was just thrilled with this ruling. Matter of fact, that may be why it happened. Isn't that amazing? But if there's any good news, says Walter Williams, it's that the tiny step the U.S. Supreme Court finally took in a 1995 case, you probably heard of this one, called U.S. v. Lopez, had to do with the Gun-Free School Zones Act, the Gun-Free Killing Zones Act. In other words, let's kill a lot of kids in school zones. Congress passed this abomination in 1990, citing their powers under, guess what, the Commerce Clause. And you know what they claimed? Yeah, possession of a firearm in a local school zone somehow substantially affected interstate commerce. Does it really matter how they come to terms with saying this is the claim? Since the point is just to justify complete control, the answer is not really. But at least, and we'll talk about this when we get back, the court saw through it a bit on this one. Welcome back, folks, to the second segment of the Come Out of Her My People show. I'm your host, Mark Hall. Today we're taking a bit of a break from mere tyranny and talking about some things that, at least in terms of a time of reflection and preparation associated with the birth of the Messiah, at this time of the harvest feast, Sukkot, a time when we dwell in booths and practice and remember things that happened in the past and that almost certainly will happen again in the future. Things in a lot of cases, at least I hope, we're looking forward to. Time of deliverance. So as we think about getting ready and as we think about what the adversary will try to do to stop that, and we have plenty of examples, what I wanted to do was go through some elements of what might be called a nexus of tyranny. How is it that they rope people into this evil? And how is it that they're going to justify, and that's exactly what will be done, the coming mark of the beast? You can see it from here. And I'm talking at least in some detail about a Walter Williams, Professor Walter Williams said it was a little known Supreme Court ruling called Wickard v. Filburn in the it was sealed in 1942. It happened over a period of several years in order to get to the Supreme Court, as you might expect. But this was a way that basically Big Brother said, hey, if it moves in commerce, if it doesn't move in commerce, if it might move in commerce, doesn't matter. We have a claim on it, and you peons, you slaves, you, we're going to regulate it because we can. The hell with that Constitution thing and all those prohibitions and restrictions that were put there in that Bill of Rights. All right. Well, one of the things that I've talked about many times on this show, I'll just mention it because I need to do it in order to be complete here, is that commerce involves what? A system of dishonest weights and measures. It's a choice of law. So I have frequently contended that if you really want to understand how this is done, recognize that commerce involves dollars, fiat bucks. How do we know that that is a way of getting entrapped into service to another master? Answer, because the God of the Bible says, if you love me, keep my commands, walk in obedience to me. Dishonest weights and measures are an abomination to him, but Big Brother loves them. It's commerce, and if you get involved in using them, why, guess what? They're going to claim, ha-ha, we got you. You use the fiat dollar, who do you serve? All us, and we're going to hold you to it. All right, back to Wickard v. Filburn, because Filburn was a farmer, and Filburn essentially grew some wheat that Big Brother said, oh, no, don't care if you intend to use it for yourself, don't care if you were going to sell it for dollars or not. Remember, we got you already. You were in the system. You had accepted these various federal controls, and once you're in for a penny, in for a pound. So where we were when I went to the break was a slight step back, a kickback against that by the Supreme Court in the U.S. v. Lopez case in 1995. And essentially, their ruling said the following, okay? It had to do with handguns in school zones. The fact that it's stupid, the fact that it violates the Second Amendment, that wasn't the issue. The claim was, oh, this has to do with the Commerce Clause. See, because we can regulate anything via commerce. Doesn't matter whether you have a right to keep and bear that shall not be infringed. It's commerce, don't you know? Well, the Supreme Court ruled saying, quote, if we were to accept the government's arguments, we'd be hard-pressed to posit any activity by any individual that Congress is without power to regulate.
In other words, once we take a single step beyond the powers explicitly enumerated in the Constitution, we are subject to a field of power that literally knows no limits whatsoever. Jefferson said something like that about 200 years earlier. And they're essentially repeating what should have been obvious. Once you claim commerce allows you to do anything you want, there is no limit on congressional power. All right. So what we see is that the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1938, part of a fascist set of emergency measures put in place by the tyrant FDR, it limited the area that farmers could devote to wheat production, and once a farmer signed up for it, they couldn't get out, like the Roach Motel that the Constitution has become. The claim was that it had to do with protecting the domestic price received by producers, and see, this is a way that farmers will fall for it. Oh, you're going to give me subsidies? You're going to protect my prices so that I don't have to worry about the market? Well, I'll take it. I'll trade essential liberty for a little temporary security. Oh, yeah, I'll trade my birthright for a cup of pottage. So there's a lot more to the story here. Filburn was given notice of his allotment in July 1940 before he planted, but despite the notices, he planted more acreage and harvested more bushels than was allotted to him. How dare he? Doesn't matter whether he says they're for his use or not. And the court unanimously claimed that the power to regulate the price at which commerce occurs was inherent in their power to regulate commerce. So, Congress could regulate wholly any intrastate non-commercial activity if such activity, viewed in the aggregate, would have a substantial effect on interstate commerce. And they'll claim anything, including whether or not you carry a handgun in a school zone, has to do with interstate commerce. Well, the Supreme Court finally said, well, no, that's a bridge too far, even for us. We can't go there. So the question then becomes, well, how far can they go? Not all the way, but pretty blankety blank and close. So whatever may not be regarded as commerce, whatever its nature, it might be reached by commerce, said one of the rulings that I'm looking at here, if it exerts a substantial economic effect on interstate commerce, whether it's direct or indirect. Wickard marked the beginning, says Williams, of the U.S. Supreme Court's total deference to Congress and its claims of power to do anything they want with the Commerce Clause. And that defense lasted till the 1990s. And, we've seen a small chink in the armor. Earl M. Maltz, in a piece about Filburn and the other New Deal decisions, wrote the following, that it gave Congress the authority to regulate private economic activity in a manner that was nearly limitless in its purview. And Lopez at least put a limit on that. That was the first decision in six decades to invalidate any federal statute on the grounds that it exceeded the power of commerce, the power of the Commerce Clause that Congress claimed to be able to regulate. In Lopez, the court held that while Congress had all kinds of lawmaking authority, it was at least a little bit limited, and it didn't extend so far from commerce as to authorize the regulation of the carrying of handguns. Well, you know what? Shall not be infringed is pretty specific. So you could say, well, at least they can read that. Again, it doesn't seem that that was the primary emphasis here, but it does seem to say, oh, well, we at least saw that it doesn't grant a limitless field of power, especially not when there's something explicitly to the contrary. And especially the court did note when there was no evidence that actually carrying them had any effect on the economy on a massive scale whatsoever. All right. The court has since relied heavily on Filburn, though. You've probably heard of some of these cases. Upholding the power of Big Brother to prosecute individuals who grow their own medical marijuana under a state law that says it's okay because that might affect interstate commerce. Gonzalez v. Reich, 2005. Homegrown marijuana is a legitimate subject of federal regulation because it competes with pot grown and moving in interstate commerce. Dr. Tom Woods said the following. Now, there is a point to all of this, and I hope you're staying with me, folks. Understand that the more we know about what now passes for law and what the real law is, remember, it's all about choose this day whom you will serve, the more we can understand the ways that Big Brother is going to try to trick you into one way or another ceding jurisdiction, giving them an ability to say, aha, gotcha, and we control you. And I will say the most obvious one of those is to use dishonest weights and measures, the fake, the almighty fiat dollar, something which, anybody that's read scripture would know. He says it carries a curse. So don't do it. You do it, Big Brother's going to say, again, gotcha. Back to Tom Woods. He says, my own thinking on this subject is that I have no superstitious reverence for the Constitution, but I like to study it because I'm persuaded by what Hans Hermann Hoppe says, that, of course, it's utopian to think that if you have a government and if you have a document that's supposed to restrain that same government, but it's that very government that gets to interpret the document, well, then what on earth do you think is going to happen? In other words, you say this document restrains them, but they get to say what it means? Guess what? How do you think that's going to work out for you? As the very same professor Walter Williams used to say, do you want to play poker with living rules, you sucker? Do you think it's going to be limited by those powers in the Constitution? What possible incentive, says Tom Woods, would they ever have for doing that? You know what's going to happen. We should expect them to find every loophole and every stretch that they can make and push it. Push it beyond the breaking point. That's exactly what Wickard v. Philbin did, and that's precisely what this whole Commerce Clause says. Well, it tells us where we're headed. It says we're going to eventually get to the place where the mark of the beast is going to be pushed on people. Without it, you will not be allowed to, say it with me, enter into commerce. Duh. Governments are not restrained by pieces of paper, says Dr. Woods, and he quotes George W. Bush. Remember, it's just a GD piece of paper. They can't possibly be. Once you realize that, it opens up a whole panorama of alternatives that you never considered before. And that was why I began with this piece from Alt Market US and Brandon Smith about black markets and some of the understandings that we need to be paying attention to. So let me go back to that with one final comment. Andrew P. Napolitano, I've got an article sitting here from him dated about 10 years ago. It was called The Worst Supreme Court Decisions in U.S. History. And right after the Marbury versus Madison that said, hey, Big Brother can write its own rules and interpret its own constitution, he picks Wickard v. Filburn as one of the top candidates for evil that's been done. Back to Brandon Smith and currencies and so forth, because what I want to do is point out that if you understand what's coming and if you recognize, well, what Scripture says about the adversary, the bad guy, the prince of this world, he comes but to steal, to kill, and destroy. That's what we're seeing. So the issue at hand, says Smith, is what happens when Big Brother governments, oligarchies, are allowed to wield that kind of centralized authority over resources, however they do it, right? Wickard v. Filburn, the Commerce Clause, or maybe it's just because you're a peon and we can kill you if we don't like you. We're going to take away your guns, and once we've got your guns, what can't we do? Hell, we haven't paid attention to the Constitution for years. Only thing holding us in check was the fact that you might somehow or other be able to scare us with that 20-gauge shotgun you've got, or that 30-06, or whatever it might be, or that AR-15. I hate those especially. So, if you look at the communist-engineered famines, says Smith, in Soviet Russia or Maoist China, you can see the very same things forming today in the West. Folks, they have been burning food processing. They have been destroying the ability of countries like Germany and farming nations like the Dutch to have things that they need to farm, like ammonia and fertilizers and so forth, diesel fuel. Ultimately, the entire food supply chain is being destroyed piece by piece, almost like a bridge that's being blown up section by section. The difference is we have historic reference, says Smith. If we're paying attention, maybe we can prevent it from happening again. But make no mistake, there are psychopaths in leadership today, and I think that might be an understatement, that have no qualms whatsoever about using food or economic access as leverage against people that they want to control. People who oppose them. Now, I'm going to note one other thing here. This, too, is arguably a subject for an entire show, but it has to do with water. Remember, evil people like Kissinger have said, yeah, if you can control the food, better still, if you can control the water, you can control the food. Then you can get people to do what you want because you can starve them. You can literally get them to die of thirst. And so you can see how many pieces start to fit together if you look at what's been going on, from the geoengineering of the weather, the moving of the jet stream, the literal, let's have some droughts in the West and we'll flood the East. Ha ha, two birds with one stone. People that don't need water got more than they know what to do with. People that would love to have some of that water, they ain't going to get any of it. And everybody gets to starve. Aren't we clever? We saw them try it during COVID, he says, and we're going to see it keep going on when it comes to the so-called climate change BS. And I've mentioned this point. I think it bears repeating again. What you're seeing, folks, in the way of climate change science is absolute. There's no polite way to put this. I'm just going to say it. Bull, you know what. The whole idea that a tiny fractional change in carbon dioxide, oh, and by the way, two oxygen atoms combining with a carbon atom, CO2, somehow it's different, they're trying to get people to believe now, when it's man-made as opposed to when it comes out of a plant. Or goes into a plant, better still, in the way of photosynthesis, because the plant needs that carbon dioxide in order to make what? Food and oxygen, so that you can live. This is about as idiotic as it can get. And part of the reason why it frosts me is because an educated, intelligent people that had any knowledge of so-called science wouldn't put up with this BS coming from the Klaus Schwabs and the Biden Führers of the world. They would literally be laughed off the international stage. If we had honest media, they would say, fact-checking? Come on. Carbon dioxide? Somehow or other, your ability to grow crops that carbon dioxide enhances? That's bad for the planet? Give me a break. You got idiots that are allowing people like Bill Gates to say, oh, yeah, we want to clear-cut 70 million acres of western forest, too. How's that for a great way to get rid of the ability of trees to process carbon dioxide into oxygen? And somehow or other, all of this is supposed to be in the name of saving the planet? They're killing the planet, folks, because the real goal is to kill hundreds of millions, no, literally, let's be honest, billions of people. Now, as I was thinking about the aspects of this show, there's one other element that I need to make sure I spend at least a minute or two on here. Because frequently I'll talk about doing the math. All right. If you just have a little bit of understanding of what it takes to produce a solar panel, all of the mining and the ability to mine the metals that make up the solar panels, that make up the aluminum and the steel that hold the solar panels in place, to build the copper for the wires, a lot of energy goes into all of that infrastructure. Guess what? That solar panel might have a life of 20 years. Great. It's going to produce a lot of solar power during that time. But if you're lucky, just maybe over its entire lifetime, if you count the entire production chain, might make about as much power as it took to mine and to smelt and to produce and to distribute and manufacture all of the stuff that went in it. Windmills, not quite so good. Windmills basically don't produce enough wind power over their life to make up for the equipment and the mining and the things that it took to produce them. These are not renewable resources, folks. These are recipes for winding down. But wait, there's even something worse, right? Electric vehicles. They require all kinds of rare earth elements and things like lithium and lanthanum and neodymium for the magnets, things that require a lot of mining to get out. And by the way, communist China controls them. That's another story besides. But it's a great way to say, hey, let's make ourselves beholden to a communist nation that intends to destroy us. How's that for smart? But if you go through the numbers with EVs, you find the same thing. There is not enough production capacity in the power grid, especially if you turn it to solar and wind, to be able to run the EVs that are already, for example, been sold to the dumbed-down population in California. And yet they want more people to have them and saying, yep, you can't charge them. Don't worry about it. We don't intend for you to be able to move or travel anyway. The point is, it doesn't take a lot of skill with the math to ask yourself the question, how could this possibly work? And the answer is, it can't. Well, wait a minute. There is one way it works. If you simply say, we're going to kill 6 or 7 billion people, they're never going to need EVs. And the peons, they're not going to be allowed to travel anyway. So, ha-ha, what we're not telling them is, they may have figured out that they don't get to own a Gulfstream 4 and burn 1,000 gallons of kerosene going from Baltimore to New York. But don't worry, they weren't ever going to be allowed to do that anyway. They're not going to be allowed to have an EV either, okay? So the only way the math works, folks, is if you kill billions of people and then say, see, the ones that are left, they might be able to have an EV once a week if we want them to be able to travel, provided they've got their mark. And if they're good little slaves and we let them. In other words, once you see how all the pieces begin to fit together, it becomes really obvious what the end game is. The adversary comes but to steal, to kill, and destroy. The point here is control. The point ultimately is mass genocide. And whether you look at food and water control, whether you look at all of the things that are being done to destroy the ability of people to have natural gas or energy or to stay warm in the winter, well, ultimately a lot of them are going to freeze to death. A lot of them are going to starve to death. They're thinking that they're going to have global warming, and ha-ha, they're not. Things are going to get colder because the sun actually has something to say about all of this, and it seems to be into a phase of cooling the planet down rather than warming it up. Guess what? They're not going to tell you about that either, because most Americans have been dumbed down to the point where they don't understand that the sun is the major driver of climate worldwide. I mean, good grief. So again, what I want people to do, what I'm encouraging folks to think about, is putting all the pieces together and saying, all right, they intend to kill you. Once you get that fact absorbed and processed, the rest of what we need to do becomes a lot more clear, doesn't it? That's kind of helped to clarify things. And ultimately, the gloves are pretty much off in a lot of respects. The gloves came off with COVID. If people didn't figure out that the Zyklon B injection wasn't about saving your lives, that socialist distancing and putting a mask over your children so that they couldn't learn simple, you know, social interaction, and by the way, that their brains would be stunted too, that wasn't part of the game. Well, what's it going to take? Answer? Well, we're going to see. So again, when you put all of this together and begin to realize what the game plan is, it's not hard. Now the question is, so what do we do? Well, the answer, of course, is the name of the show. Come out of her, my people. Be separate. Do not participate in the sin so you don't partake of the plagues. As always, though, the devil is in the details. How do we do it? So one of the things that I hope you got out of the show today has to do with this idea of, well, call it what it will be called, black markets. How can we engage in not commerce, in other words, trade with people, and do so in a way that is actually, if we still had a constitution, legal and lawful? I'm talking about lawful U.S. coin, silver coinage that is minted in the United States in or before 1964 is lawful U.S. coin. And you can trade for it. And by the way, you can trade for it without, if you're careful, taking a license from Big Brother to have backyard chickens. Why would you want a license from Big Brother to do something you have a God-given, constitutionally protected right to do? Why would you ask permission to buy a firearm? Well, see, if it's a firearm, maybe they do have a... How about a projectile-based self-defense weapon? In other words, they will use all kinds of tools to claim control over you. The fake money is one. Made up words is another. Shall not be infringed. But hey, we didn't say that if you didn't allow us to do it, that we wouldn't take advantage of it. The more you learn about, the more you understand the ways that you're being roped into a system, as Jefferson said correctly, foreign to our Constitution and laws, the better off you'll be. So understand, this commerce thing that's associated with the mark of the beast is particularly satanic and insidious. Wickard v. Filburn was the tool that they used to get here. There has been a bit of pushback against it, but ultimately I'm going to suggest that if you have, say, backyard chickens or goats, or you decide that when the economic breakdown comes, I have the ability to, help people as a chiropractor, for example. Do I need a license to crack somebody's back? Well, it depends. Do I want to write a pharmaceutical prescription, or do I simply want to help my neighbor in exchange for some eggs or a little bit of silver coin? If you are careful and understand what commerce is and isn't, and how you can simply trade with your fellow Americans, because we both serve the same creator, we're both created in his image, and we both know what the real law is, see, that's a whole different deal. Those whom he has made free are free indeed. Don't ever forget that. That is at the very heart of what we're talking about. I think it's at the very heart of what this season is intended to teach us, right? If we can come out of all kinds of things that are associated with the world and with various fakes, the season kind of helps us to understand that. The birth of the real Messiah as opposed to a fake that did away with his own law. And what does the real Messiah say? Well, he wrote his instruction for us. He says it hasn't changed. He's the same. It's the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Not one yod or tittle has passed away. Guess what? If we walk in obedience to him, if we trade honestly with honest weights and measures with our brethren, if we give good value, if we honor our covenants, our contracts with one another, if we watch one another's back, if we are prepared for the things that are coming, we are a heck of a lot
better equipped and able to deal with the evil that has already revealed itself and that has made it clear that it intends to kill you. So don't let them, and understand what it means to be under the protection of the Most High. And to do that, folks, we have to understand at least a little bit about the law. Certainly whose law, but also the real law. What was once called, in this country anyway, the law of the land. And it was based on His word. And it still is. That is, if you understand the tricks and how not to trade your birthright for a cup of pottage or your essential liberties once protected by that law for a little temporary, fake, so-called safety. So, I'll say it again. Choose this day whom you will serve. And the answer? You can't serve two masters. So, as for me and my house, said Joshua, we will serve Yahuwah. And the salvation of Yahuwah later made it clear that that needs to be Him alone. Have a blessed Sukkot, folks, and may Yahuwah bless you and yours.